Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Eso amago natiyanyo dasanasa visuddhiyati. One of my favorite sayings from the Dhammapada. This, the Eightfold Path, is the only path. There is no other for the purity of insight and seeing. It's a very beautiful saying there. The Eightfold Path, not Samatha, not Vipassana, not this meditation, that meditation, but the whole Eightfold Path. That is the only path. And for this series of talks, the very beginning of a range retreat, I always focus on just the meditation, how to meditate. And that is a very important thing always to remember. The Eightfold Path is important if you want to learn how to meditate. It's not just a case of sitting down on your butt or on a chair or laying down or walking and thinking, I'm going to meditate. Without the support of the other factors of the Eightfold Path, they are really, really, really important. And if you can get those in line, then you find the meditation just takes off. So, you look at yourself and just see, you know, my right speech, action, and livelihood, is that really pure? Because if it's not, it doesn't matter just how much effort, how much skill, how much wisdom you put into sitting down or watching your mind, it doesn't work. And don't think it's come up to someone like me and say, Ajahn Brahm, been thinking too much. Ajahn Brahm, I just fall asleep all the time. Ajahn Brahm, I just can't focus on my breath or anything. I can't be in the present moment. Why? Have a look at the precepts. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. Which is, you know, just speaking kind words all the time. And most of the time, not speaking at all. Restraining. Because if you do restrain the speech, you find that the thoughts get restrained. So often that people always meditate and they say they can't stop the thinking. Why is that? Because they can't stop the talking. Stop the talking first, and then there's a good chance you might stop the thinking. So why do we need to speak all the time? Why do we need to assert that we're here? Just disappear, vanish, and be this calm, quiet person who hardly ever speaks at all. And those are the people, not always, but often, those are the people who can meditate and you hardly hear them. And they can hardly hear their thoughts. So we restrain our talking so we can restrain our thoughts. And obviously, if you can't restrain the mouth, you can't restrain talking, how on earth do you ever think you can restrain the thoughts in the mind, which are far more subtle? So start with the talking and see if you can be more quiet. And I don't mean noble silence where you don't talk at all. That is not noble at all. It is just talking at the right time, but talking very little. So as the Buddha said, your words are like treasure. Treasure is things which are rare. If you talk too much, then no one really listens to you. Sometimes I wonder why you guys listen to me. I've talked so much. But that's my job. But please, restrain the speech. And restrain the actions. You know, do kind things for one another. Nothing ever mean. Livelihood is pretty good in this place. Because it's a serving. It's a livelihood. Unfortunately, you just can't expect other people to serve you all the time. It would be wonderful if I could just stay in my cave for the next 10 years and you just look after me and feed me and serve me and wash all my robes and never come and ask any question at all. Sometimes people would ask, Ajahn Brahm, you know, you work too hard. Come on a retreat. Come on a retreat to Prague or to Norway or to some place. And what they really mean is that they got me so they can ask all their questions of me. It's not going on a retreat, it's just me serving them. So that I realise what that's going on. And it's dead. You know, service and solitude, the balance. That is right livelihood for a monk. And I've mentioned this before. The monks here know this, that if you just do solitude practice, because unfortunately I've seen this too often, monks who have all the time by themselves, who manage to work the system, and it's working the system, other people have to do their visas, other people have to get all the requisites for them, other people have to do this for them and do that for them, and they're always asking lay people to do this and do that, but they never actually serve at all. Other people do the service. Sometimes you get away with that in Thailand because so many other monks and teachers have been doing the service for such a long time. You couldn't get away with that in Australia. You had to serve, otherwise you would get no food, no place to stay. So there is a balance there. And those monks in Thailand I saw who just did solitude and no service, they never got anywhere. The monks know this. Why is that? It wasn't right livelihood. Being a hermit without any service, I say, is not right livelihood. It means that because you're giving nothing at all, your mind gets very dry. It doesn't have the compassion, the kindness, the heart to really actually to power you into deep meditation. It doesn't have the joy. Obviously, too much service gets you nowhere. You just get exhausted and tired. The balance there, the balance of service and solitude, that becomes right livelihood. But it's also that if you've got the wrong view, the first factor of Eightfold Path, it's so hard to meditate. And of course, the first part, the major part of wrong view is that you think that you're doing this, the sense of I, that I exist as a self, as a soul, as a me somewhere inside. And that is one of the biggest hindrances to meditation, the idea that you're doing this. The idea that there's something that you are going to attain. All these attainments and goals, there's always an I, a me, behind all of that. All this wanting, all this attaching even. I was mentioning this to someone recently. It's an old simile which I had, because I was always concerned about this thing called attachment. It was such a hard thing to cut off. You know, because I'd pick up one thing and put it down and then pick up another thing. I remember this very clearly as a young monk. I was a young man, sexually active, become a monk, and you had to give up girls, had to give up that sort of pleasure when you became a monk. And I found I gave that pleasure up and I started getting attached to food. And look, this is weird, but it didn't matter what the quality of the food was. And it was disgusting food in northeast Thailand. I've told you too many stories about that. But still, you got attached and look forward to that food. You know, even the gross stuff, it was weird. And so one attachment had gone, and then you picked up another attachment. And then you sort of restrained the food. And then it was like, from all things, like Pepsi Colas. I hate that stuff, but because that's the only sweet thing you had, which had a bit of caffeine in it, you got attached to that. And I still remember, it's a crazy little story. And again, these stories I've said before. I remember just maybe 4 years as a monk, and one afternoon I had a Time magazine, which was really rare in those days, one of the only English things you could read, except the Abhidhamma. And the Time magazine, actually that was exaggerated, we didn't have the Abhidhamma, no books there. But it was like that. A Time magazine and a bottle of Pepsi. And I sat down in a chair, and I remember that so clearly. I thought to myself, life doesn't get better than this. That's how weird my life had got with all that restraint. To me, that was just the height of indulgence. A Pepsi Cola and a Time magazine to read. Oh, that's not so bad. But anyway, just those attachments, you're always picking up something, until I started thinking, it's why am I always focusing on the object of attachment? Because attachment has got two ends to it. It's the thing you get attached to, that's the outer end, and the inner end, this end of that claw, that hand, the thing doing the attaching. So after a while, it became endless. You know, just restraining this, I could put one thing down, I'd pick up another, put that down, pick up another, put one thing down, give up sex, and he got food, put down food, he gets something else to pick up. All these little attachments which you have, always picking something up. And obviously you look very carefully, just not at the object, not what was out there. Go the opposite direction. That's called yonisamanasikara. Go to the source of this. And it's just like the other simile I was saying that to a few people. I remember going to the movies as a kid in England, in London, in these big movie theatres. And of course in those days, 50s and early 60s, people were allowed to smoke. You didn't have videos or things on the you can download on a computer. You had to go to the movie theatre. It's a big hall here. And people smoked, and so the hall was always really smoky. But that had the advantage. Sometimes, I remember clearly, looking at the movie, and then tracing back this cone of light, because, you know, the light had been diffused, reflected by the smoke particles. You see this cone of light, and you can trace it back. And as I traced this cone of light back, I saw it was coming from a little room in the very back of the theatre, and you can see a little guy in there just standing by this machine, the projector. And that's all it was, just this celluloid just passing through this light. And that was the movie I was watching. When you trace it back to the source, then you actually get some insight. You realise these weren't monsters on the screen. This wasn't sort of real bandits or gunslingers or real horses. It was just a play of light creating an illusion. When I could actually see that, because you trace it back and the smoke-filled theatre and the cone of light helped me do that. And you realise it was only a movie, that's all. Which means I never needed to get scared when it was a horror movie. I never needed to get excited, only if I wanted to. And obviously sometimes you did indulge in that, but you knew in the back of the mind it was only a movie. So you never really got that scared or that emotional when you watch movies. That was a very good help for me, because that's the same with thoughts. You never get so involved in the thoughts and the fantasies, because you trace it back where it's coming from. It's nothing. Just a play of silly ideas on your mind with no substance to it at all. And that's what it means by going back to the source of things. And this time I was going back to the source of my attachment. Now, what was doing the attaching? And of course it was this identity, me, this Ajahn Brahm. That was the thing doing the picking up. And as long as I hadn't seen that, you'd put one thing down, you'd pick up another. You let go of one thing and you get another thing in your hand. And you realise it was this thing inside. That was what needed to be seen and restrained, not what's out there. Out there was secondary. It's what's in here. That was what you had to focus on and watch. Once you became aware of that, this sense of self, of a me, then actually you had the trick to be able to let go of things. It's one thing to say, let go of your thoughts, let go of your possessions, let go of your ideas and your views and stuff like that. And people find it hard to do. It's the question they always ask me. Yes, I know I should let go, but how do I let go? Trace the attachment to the source. Who's doing this thinking? What is actually attaching to this idea, this view? This indulgence, this sensory pleasure, what attaches to it? When you trace it back, you see there's absolutely nothing in there at all. It's empty. There's no self. There is no being in there. If you don't see that, at least you can actually take it on trust. The Buddha's teaching, say again and again and again and again and again, there's nothing in there. So take it on faith. Imagine there's nobody in there. Imagine there's not a Sangharatana, there's not a Chanda, there's not an Upeka, there's not a Karunika, there's not an Ajahn Brahm. Just imagine what it would be like if there's no one in there. And then meditate. Meditate imagining there's no self. Because as Westerners, modern people, you know, we've we do have our fantasies and imagination. We develop that ability very, very much. People can imagine that they are the striker for Liverpool and score the winning goal in the European Championships. Chaka. You can imagine that you are this great rock guitarist. You can imagine, I don't know what else you imagine, you're the best lover in the whole of Norway. It's okay, there's two Norwegian monks here, so I won't say which one it is. Whatever it is, I mean, you can imagine all sorts of stuff. But if you can imagine that, and some of these monks have fantasies for half an hour, I don't know how long. What about have the fantasy of being no self? Use that power of imagination. Imagine you're sitting here, no one in here at all. Now you find it's very difficult to actually to hang on to anything. It's very hard to attach to anything. Letting go becomes automatic. You need someone in here to do the clinging on. You do need someone in here to be concerned and worried about what thought is going on in the head or what pain or what suffering there is out there in the world. Because when there's no one in here, it's just suffering, that's all. Dukkha arising, dukkha passing away. It's just people come in the monastery, people leave. Thoughts come, thoughts go. Nimittas come, nimittas go. That's all there is. So once you actually to imagine it like that, at least you're fantasizing right view instead of fantasizing wrong view. You're imagining it, you're playing, you're seeing what it might be like. And just that much can really help. The reason why I got this, it just comes back to me now because this guy just, he recently wrote a letter to me from my birthday, still keeps in touch. And he's actually the guy in Good Bad Who Knows, whose mother died in Essex and came to visit him in Nollamara at night time. The only time he's ever seen a ghost. Great story. You know, just she was standing at the end of the bed. You know, the end of the bed story. It's traditional. I don't know why they stand at the end of the bed, but that's what many ghosts do. And it's his mum. And he was the only time he's ever seen a ghost, and they're not scared at all, he told me. It's really weird, he said. Saw her, you know, turned the light on, it wasn't in the dark, not imagining it, just seeing it as you would see the person standing in front of you in the middle of the day. It was his mum. And she lived in London. This was in Perth. She knew his mum had died. He knew his mum had died. And he said it was not just a flash either, it was for a couple of minutes, 3 or 4 minutes. And just, he was in bed, just, you know, leaning up, and his mum at the end of the bed smiling at her. At him, and he felt it was so warm and wonderful. His mum had come to see him before she finally left. And he said, after 2 or 3 minutes, he just vanished, disappeared slowly. And of course, being English, he did what any Englishman would do after you have an experience like that. You ask Venerable Chanda, what is it? Cup of tea, yes. Put the kettle on and have a cup of tea. So he was having his cup of tea and the phone rang. It was his sister from England. Pete, got bad news for you. Yeah, I know, mum's died. What? How on earth did you know? We'd just come back from the hospital. I remember that conversation. It was like a nice ghost. But anyway, where was I going with this? This Peter, he was... What was I saying before?
Not self.
There was something about Peter and a nice story. About.
I wrote you a letter.
Rubbing your head recently, that's only why I remember this.
Imagining something.
You what?
Attachments.
Yeah, I know. See, I let go of ideas. Imagine. Oh, that's right, imagination, yes. Because... Don't blame me, it's not me. But he was saying that one of his... He never told me who this teacher was, but I really respect this teacher. He was always having trouble watching his breath, doing the old breath meditation. And, you know, he could watch his breath for more than maybe 2 or 3 breaths in a row. And his teacher, it was a brilliant idea. The teacher actually said to him, don't watch your breath. Imagine. Just sit down, close your eyes, imagine you're watching your breath. Just imagine it. And so he closed his eyes, try anything to do a bit of meditation. It was just imagining what it must be like to watch the breath go in, watch the breath go out. And he was doing this for 3 or 4 minutes, and the teacher said, what are you watching? And he said, my breath. Because the difference between imagination and reality is not that far. And so, you know, it was a brilliant way of meditating. If you can't watch your breath, imagine you watching your breath. If you can't be silent, imagine you are silent. If you can't let go, imagine you are letting go. If you can't be happy and depressed, imagine you're happy. What it must be like to be happy. It's an incredible, powerful little method which can be cultivated. And especially imagine there's no one in here. Imagine right view. What it must be like if Ajahn Brahm didn't exist. And then, what could I try and aspire for? What's the point of actually trying to get jhanas or trying to get enlightened? There's no one in here. And all this trying, all these goals, all these attainments, they tend to vanish and disappear. You're peaceful because there is nothing to do because there's no one to do anything. And when there's no one to do anything, you can't do anything. And you find you get peaceful and still. The thoughts vanish. The reason why you think is because you really imagine there's someone doing the thinking. There's no one doing the thinking. It's just cause and effect. It's a process. So leave it alone. Let it go. You've got no choice but to let it go when you imagine right view. There's nobody in here. And there's nothing to attach to. And there's nothing to attain. All attainments just become attachments for people. That's all they are. Attachments. Oh, this. I told this story to the monks earlier, but this is to the jhana groovies especially. This is a story which I heard when I was in San Francisco last February. There's a the story of the attainments. There's always weird stuff goes on in the world, and mostly in like so-called Buddhist countries. This was in Colombo, in Sri Lanka. There's a group who were doing these retreats, and at the end of the retreat, they give you an exam, and they would say whether you were a stream winner, once return, a non-return, or an arahat, and they give you a certificate afterwards. You know, it's one of those type of stupid retreats. And there was this really, you know, sometimes the people who you think are the most less educated, so the less educated, the more simple people, especially the old Sri Lankan women, be wary of those. Because there's this old Sri Lankan woman, you know, from some village in the middle of nowhere, in the bush somewhere, was visiting some relation in Colombo, a devoted Buddhist going to the temple for poya days, offering alms. But you know, that everyone thought that, you know, she was just, you know, one of these devoted Buddhists but didn't really have any practice. Even these days, people think that of, the Thai people. They say, oh, they give all this food, but they don't really practice. Be careful of your judgment. Some of these are very good meditators. So be careful of judging people. Anyway, this simple old lady visiting Colombo, and one of her relations said, there is this course, this retreat on. I want to sponsor you to go. Who knows? You have enough faith when you learn a bit more teachings of the sutras and do some meditations. You might actually get somewhere. Who knows? And so they paid for her to go in this course about 2 or 3 weeks. I forget how long. In the end, they gave her an examination. And proudly they came to her with a Sotapanna certificate. Say, well done. You are now a stream winner. At which she got very upset, really angry. She was irate. She was ropeable. She was going to kill somebody, sort of. Not maybe I'm exaggerating a bit, but she was not happy at all. And they couldn't understand, why aren't you happy? You're a stream winner. No more. This would be a great sense of joy for you. You don't have to go to the lower realms ever again. You're a stream winner. You're bound for enlightenment. Only 6 more lifetimes at most. Why are you so upset? And then she looked at them with anger and said, "Don't you remember me?" Said, "No, we don't. Well, who are you?" "I was here last year, and last year you gave me a non-returner certificate." "I've been demoted." They didn't recognize her. It's a good story. That's what happens with attainments. You know, if you get an attainment, you might lose it next time, get demoted. That's all about me and mine and a self, for goodness sake. So that's why, if you can meditate on this next week, 2 months, however long we've got here, just with the idea there's no one in here, then what are you trying to attain? What are you trying to get? What other attachment are you trying to have? Because those attainments become attachments to people when they don't understand what they really are. And there's lots of people, you know, unfortunately, they hear of these things. And some, please excuse me, idiot goes along and says, "You're a stream winner, a once returner, a non-returner." And they believe it and cause them so much problems because they're getting, they take that on as a personal attainment. And you should all know there is no such things as personal attainments in Buddhism because there is no person. Who the heck can attain anything? It's not about getting things, it's about losing things. And this is one of the reasons I've been emphasizing for the last 3 or 4 weeks. We're here not to attain anything, but to let go of things. That's Ajahn Chah's teaching. And I remember him saying that. And that monk was a great teacher. So when you meditate, are you meditating with right view? Or are you meditating with wrong view? The wrong factor of the Eightfold Path. If it's wrong view, it's I am trying to get something. Or I, my meditation is no good. Same thing. You've got a self there, you're judging your meditation, you think you own it. Your meditation has literally got nothing to do with you. It's not your business. That's one of my favorite sayings. When I meditate, sometimes I do have mantras just to get me going. And one of the mantras I use is, none of my business. I like that because sometimes, you know, people call up and they want me to do this and do that. None of my business. They want me to chant because their dog is sick. That's not my business. They want me to sort of intervene because they can't find the boyfriend they love. It's not my business. I'm a monk, for goodness sake. They want me to chant so that they become rich or they get the lottery. Oh, that's not my business. And sometimes monks come and ask about their meditation. That's not my business. Just a teacher doing the teaching stuff. But it's not my business. And I love thinking like that. None of my business. And when I sit down and meditate, I love doing that too. I sit down, close my eyes. Now, my nose is itchy. None of my business. Nose is your business. You want to sneeze? Sneeze. You don't want to? Don't want to. But it's none of my business, okay? And I'm tired. Being tired, that's none of my business. Thinking, that's none of my business. And isn't it beautiful when you have that idea that it's none of my business? That's my mantra. Which means nothing's my business. Which means got nothing to do. Which means I do nothing. And any peace which comes, that's none of my business either. Beautiful lights come, that's none of my business. I don't reject it, because rejecting it means it's my business to get rid of it. It's just, you're just equanimous to it. It's not yours, it doesn't belong to you. Somebody else's. So because of that, you leave it alone. You let go. To let go, too often we're focusing on the object, not the subject of the letting go. So imagining there's nobody in there, it's so easy to let go. It's not my meditation, I'm not trying to get somewhere. Too often, especially if you have your own personal retreat, my own personal retreat, right, this is it, I'm going to really get something this time. Oh, please, come on, you're just asking for trouble. I've warned you about this too many times. If you have your goals, your to-do list, things you have to achieve on this retreat, you are asking for suffering, and you will get suffering. Imagine what it's like having nothing to do. I mean, really nothing to do. I don't mean just to think and play around. That's doing something. I mean, really nothing to do. Nothing to think, nothing to fantasize, nothing to gain, no pleasure to achieve, no time to kill. That's another doing things. It's amazing just how that gets you straight into this present moment, and you make peace with this moment. Because all doing, all jobs create the future. This craving, wanting creates a future. When we just don't want anything, the whole idea, future as you knew it, vanishes. And when the future as you knew it, as you perceived it, vanishes, then a whole heap of suffering vanishes with it. Fear, even hope and plans, all vanish as well. Imagine having no future. What would that be like? It's another great imagination to do when you meditate. Fantasize that your future is destroyed. There is no tomorrow. There is no 5 minutes time. Imagine that. You can't do anything now. There's nothing to achieve. There's nothing to get rid of. There's nothing to do. You're peaceful. All of these things as ways of using right view in order to let go. Because if you're not letting go, behind that attachment, behind that doing, behind that controlling, right behind there, there's wrong view lurking. The other one of the right view, suffering. And, you know, the Buddha said, no, sabbe sankhara dukkha, it's all suffering, it's all dukkha, so what are you trying to attain? Just more dukkha? I love that little simile, you know, just which I developed. You know, we always think that if I move to another place, then I won't have any dukkha anymore. I won't have any suffering. And the old simile of the two sisters, one was single, one was married. I still see them every now and again, or at least the one which was married. And she was the one to get rid of her husband, and her sister wanted to get a husband. So I said, one, you've got single woman suffering. That's what it's like being single. And the other one, you've got married woman suffering. That's what it's like being married. So you married woman, if you get rid of your husband, you'll have what your sister has, single woman suffering. You single woman, if you get rid of, if you get a husband, you will have married woman suffering. You haven't got a kid, you've got woman without kid suffering. You get a kid, you have woman with kid suffering. You decide, okay, it's all suffering, I'm going to become a nun. Now you have nun suffering. You know, junior nun, become a senior nun, you have senior nun suffering. You're doing all the building work, went on Karunika, now you have building nun suffering. Now, be careful, Venerable Karunika, the building is almost finished. When it's finished, you will have none with nothing to do suffering. Be careful, because we always think, once it's finished, then I'll be happy. That's such a big problem. When I finish translating the Vinaya, then I'll be happy. I used to think like that. When I finish building this monastery, when it's all finished, then I'll be happy. Still building it. So I decided I'm going to be happy now. When I get jhana, then I'll be happy. That's another form of suffering. Be happy now, before you get jhana. Otherwise you'll never get jhana. So this is always that future thing. When I get something, then I'll be happy. All that is you're just transferring one type of dukkha for another type of dukkha. It doesn't work. So understanding what dukkha is there's nothing worth attaining. It's nothing, was it? Was it Sabbang the Abhinivesanaya quote, Sabbangalang Abhinivesanaya. So that there's nothing at all deserves to actually to be gone for. Abhinivesanaya. Nivesana is like the word for like a house or a dwelling. There's no thing worth actually dwelling in. Nothing at all. It's a very beautiful saying of the Buddha. Even jhanas. Now the reason he says that, it doesn't mean that you discard jhanas, but you don't aim for them. You don't grasp them. You don't try and get them. You don't try and get to be a stream winner. You don't aim for it. You don't try and attain it, because that's just always the self behind that. And that's why it never works. That's why people can meditate for years or think they're meditating and never get anywhere. And they get frustrated. I can't meditate. And I said this to you before. Of course you can't meditate. Ajahn Brahm cannot meditate. I said that to you. You know, it's not a joke. It's just a point of Dhamma. Ajahn Brahm has to vanish. And then meditation happens. All my cravings, desires, what I want, all my goals, they vanish. And then all this stuff happens. So if you think, I can't meditate, join the club. The problem is not that you're failing somewhere, there's something wrong with you. The point is that you've got this you in there, this wrong view. And you're starting meditating from that wrong view, and that is why it doesn't work. It's one of the reasons why that sometimes people give up. They give up trying, frustrated, had enough. And that's a beautiful thing to achieve, giving up, frustrating. Sometimes you need a lot of suffering to be able to let go. Wise people, they don't need to go into such depths of despair. They can let go beforehand. So let go of trying. I was telling a few, telling some people on retreat, I told a few of the jhana groovies this. I said, look, come on, be honest with yourself. You're hopeless. You're not going to get anywhere in this retreat. Now, I wasn't being that to put somebody down. That was some dharma there. Be hopeless, all you monks in this monastery. You know, how many years you've been trying to meditate here? Have you got jhanas yet? Come on, be honest. You're hopeless, aren't you? So do you think you're going to get it this year? No way. Give up. Give up. Come on. Let go. Let go of the sense of self, for goodness sake. When you get rid of the sense of self, and you have a bit of right view, once you have this understanding of what suffering is, and nothing is worth going for anyway, just more suffering, it's a different type of suffering. So once you have that right view, then a letting go happens. You don't do the letting go. Right view is the cause for letting go. You establish the cause, and then the letting go happens as a natural result. That's how it works. And then, it's amazing. You're just sitting here, you haven't been able to meditate for weeks, months, years. You're sitting here, oh, I now understand what right view is. And if you can accept it or imagine it, fantasize it, just imagine what it's like if you didn't have right view. You know what right view is, and just imagine it. Just fill your whole world with that. And then things disappear. You let go. And when you let go, future vanishes, past also. All this activity, this doing vanishes. The lake becomes really still. Thoughts, they go. And it's amazing. I didn't make them go. They just went by themselves. And the stillness is peace there. I didn't do this. It's just there. And the peace becomes blissful. Wow, this is really neat. I didn't want this. It just happens. And I'm not experiencing this. It's just there. It's not me. I didn't do anything. It's none of my business. It's what happens when I stop doing things. And then you get the jhanas. And in those states, you know, it's obvious there wasn't anybody there. Because this is where the non-self manifests really strongly. It just sometimes I think people have to be, what they say in Australia, like Blind Freddy. have to be really dumb and dull not to actually see that there's nobody in there when you get a decent jhana. Will gone. The thing which knows is just vanishing really fast. Just obvious. And then you come out afterwards and you realize just why. You know, few people actually get these stages. It's because they keep trying. They keep doing it. They look upon these things as attainments. They look upon these as personal achievements. And they struggle and strive and they want. And that's why they never achieve this sort of stuff. But if you can just learn how just to let go a little bit, let go of the sense of self, get right view. And so, Aso Wamago Natiyanyo Dasanasa Visuddhiya, you know, the Eightfold Path is a way to meditate. And I've often also focused on the second factor of right intention. That's been a big thing which I've focused on over the last few years, which is intentions, you know, what you're aiming for. It's almost like trying, but what is actually right trying? And it's actually intentions of renouncing, nekama, giving up, saying no, relinquishing. That's, you know, where it's all coming from. It's not to get things, but to renounce, relinquish things. Nekama. And that's actually why the first jhana, one of the descriptions, what it's like in these deep states of blissful meditation, is called Nekama Sukha, the bliss of having renounced everything. Oh, what joy! There's nothing, hardly anything left. So much stuff has gone. Joyful. No body, no senses, no will. Ah. It's a joy of letting go. In the world, people think that joy comes in accumulating stuff. The more we have, the more happy we will be. The more money, the more gifts, the more sex, the more movies, the more gigs on your tablet, the happier you will be. That is accumulation. Monks. It's letting go of stuff. That's why I always say that my favourite button on my, it's not a tablet, it's a notepad or book or whatever, is the delete button. I love the delete button. And you know what happened, sisters? I keep on saying these things in public and it comes back to haunt me. One of my favourite tools in the office is the shredder. And somebody brought me a shredder for my birthday. And I'm trying to find some way to shred the shredder. Get rid of it. Goodness sake, I don't want the stuff. Whole idea, the reason I like a shredder is I get rid of stuff. I don't want something to... What stuff? Anyway, thank you anyway. It was a nice try, but not really up to scratch. You try and get rid of stuff. And that's not accumulating, but letting go of stuff. And that's the first factor of the second part of the Noble Eightfold Path. Nekama Sankhapa. And if you're not having Nekama Sankhapa, your meditation's not going to get anywhere. Renouncing. See how much you can let go of, not how much you can accumulate in your mind. Don't try and be smarter. Don't try and, I don't know what else, you know, to be liked more. Renounce everything, for goodness sake. And of course the other two, kindness. Simple, simple, simple. Compassion, loving kindness. That's Avayapada Sankhapa. And Ahimsaka Sankhapa, the gentleness, not violence. Some people can be so violent with their speech and actions, but nothing like the violence they do inside their own head when they're meditating. So be kind, be gentle, and just let go. That's such a powerful meditation teaching. And you're not just saying, oh, you watch the breath, and you count so many breaths, and you watch it here, and then the nimitta comes, and then this is what you do. That's all very nice stuff, but you've got to get the foundations right, first of all. And all this other stuff, it happens by itself once the foundations are there. None of my business. I'm just suffering anyway, so what do I want? Just one type of suffering for another type of suffering doesn't get you anywhere. I'm letting go of stuff, not accumulating. Sometimes that's what happens when you do get an experience. You attach to it, and you defend it when somebody challenges it. My experience, I'm a stream winner. Why do you say I'm not a stream winner? People get so upset. It shows they've really got hold of that experience and made a self out of it. It's my experience. I'm enlightened and you're not. This attachment again. That is the whole thing, is against the path. We're letting go of stuff. We're vanishing, not attaining. Got nothing to define us by. When you do things like that, then all this stuff happens. And this is one of the major teachings which I'm giving you. When you try, you stop things happening. And the Buddha says that. This is not just Ajahn Chah. The Buddha says this, second factor of the Eightfold Path. Thoughts of renunciation, of kindness, of gentleness. Fundamental if you want to have the purity of insight. And then the effort comes. The effort, what causes the right effort? The effort comes from the intentions, you know, the underlying force behind what you do. So when it's, you know, it's intentions of renunciation, kindness and gentleness, then this is actually what the effort actually becomes. It's not what you do. So that's the trouble with that whole idea of right effort. Confused me for years. I thought effort is something I do. It didn't make sense when there's no I there. It goes against fundamental right view. So right view has to inform even right effort. And so does right intention too, has to inform it. And when you put those two together, right view and right intention, to right effort, it's quite clear what the effort is. It is, you know, not what you do, what happens automatically. When there's no self, when there's just suffering arising, suffering passing away, what you're trying to get anyway, you really disappear, you let go. And that becomes the effort. And that effort just starts to empower the mindfulness. Mindfulness, again, the mindfulness phenomena of modern age, another thing which you do. I am going to be mindful. Okay, I will be mindful for the next hour. Okay. You try that, you stuff yourself up again. You can't force mindfulness. You find its causes, and those causes all come from just things like right view and right intention. That's the other thing which few teachers really make clear. My mindfulness is something whose power increases. It's not just a thing which knows. It knows deeply, it knows more deeply, more powerfully, more intense. Intense maybe not the best word, but just the strength of it gets more and more and more. And you need that degree of mindfulness to see just all the obstacles, all the hindrances and overcome them. And that's why when you get into these jhanas, sometimes people, I don't know why they say these things, they say, oh, you're just dull, you're just sleepy, you don't know what's going on. It's crazy talk. You've never been more aware in your whole life than in the deep meditations. It's like the rest of life is just dullness. Like you're half asleep and now, at last, you're awake, alert. Still blissed out, but very, very alert. It's superpower mindfulness. And it's not something you do. So you can't even come out afterwards and think you've attained that. You know you haven't attained it. It's just what happens when you stop all this attainment rubbish. You stop trying, getting things. All of you who haven't understood this, you get so dispirited. You know, just why aren't there more monks who get jhanas? It's because there are too many monks themselves who are trying to get these things. You vanish and disappear, and this is all that's left. It's just jhanas. So when everything else vanishes and disappears, it's a default position of the mind. jhanas. You know, use that word default, just when everything else vanishes, that's almost like the screensaver of the mind. And that's actually pretty accurate. That's why just Buddha would just, when he wasn't doing anything, that's what he would, where he would hang out. Didn't go try and get them. Just when he wasn't doing anything, this is what happens. Now you understand what these things are and why they are the cause of deepest of insights. Because once these things happen, it's not just even just the experience, it's just how it happens. How it happens gives you the knowledge of things as they truly are. No self in here. Nothing to attain, nothing to grasp onto, nothing to sort of work so hard to get and feel so ashamed when you don't get these things. Stop all that sort of stuff. That's all self, that's all worldly stuff. You're monastics, even those who are just coming here just for a few months. You go here and go back to Germany or to Hong Kong, wherever you're going, go back with less than you came with. Less attainments, less experiences, less self, less of a sense of identity. So this is what we're doing here, we're disappearing, vanishing. And these are just stages of letting go, stages of vanishing, the jhanas. And just see how much can vanish. And if you can't actually do it, just imagine it. Fantasize this evening. Fantasize of just sitting here and everything just disappearing. There's no one in here. Fantasize right for you. It actually works. It's a very good skillful means. So that's the talk this evening.
Patipano Bhagavata.